Doug, you are clearly fascinated by the history of the first people who came to the Americas, which is still a huge mystery to historians and archaeologists. Why are you so interested in this story?
Well, I decided I needed to write a book about 8 years ago, and the cardinal issue of my generation is global warming. It's the collective damage we brought upon the planet. And however, telling that story is, it's a bummer. And I find myself uncomfortable telling high school students exactly what I think about it. And the question I ask myself, have Homo sapiens ever gone through a period of global warming before? And the answer is yes, indeed, they did. Right once, right here in North America, when humans first showed up and started to colonize this continent. And that was about 15,000 years ago. And that global warming allowed people to colonize the land south of the ice, which is the continental United States. And, you know, it allowed them great technological breakthroughs. It created the possibility for the first successful colonization of the lower states, you know, the so-called Clovis people who hunted mammoth.
And this was the period when, I mean, glaciers had once covered much of North America, but as they melted, then people moved in.
Yeah. 20,000 years ago, that was the last great advance. There was ice across the continent, Canada, from sea to sea. And then about 15,000 years ago, it slowly began to melt, and the glaciers began to recede. They opened up the coastline of the Pacific Northwest for boats, if people indeed had boats back then, and I'm sure they did. And eventually it melted a corridor down at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, the so-called Rocky Mountain Trench, which is a corridor all the way from Alaska between the mountains, and it empties out down into Alberta and Montana, where I live.
Now, there are a lot of competing theories about when people first came to North America. Some scholars think it was fairly recent, maybe 13,000 years ago, and there are others who believe that it happened much earlier, maybe tens of thousands of years ago. What's your best guess?
Well, the best evidence, given the lack of really hard dates that precede 13,000 years, comes from the field of genetics. And that's a recent field, and it's just opened up all possibilities. Geneticists think that the first humans showed up in North America about 30,000 years ago, but they didn't get very far south until 15,000 years ago, and only a few of them were down here, you know, before the Great Corridor opened. Maybe 13,000 years ago or so. So, you know, that's plausible. But those people, those theoretical people that geneticists want to tell us, they were hanging around the Beringia, which is the vast area of ice-free Siberian Alaska, you know, 15,000 years ago. It seemed to have been almost invisible people. We haven't found an archaeological trace of people up there, with the exception of one site in western Beringia, in Siberia, not very far from the Arctic Sea, and that's a 30,000-year-old date in Siberia. But we don't have anything on this side of the Bering Straits at all.
And then there's another theory that people may have had access to boats. I mean, we know that in other parts of the world at this time, I mean, people were seafaring, and it's possible that they might have come down the west coast of North America, possibly all the way down to South America a long time ago.
No doubt. I mean, a short history of Homo sapiens is we came out of Africa about 70,000 years ago following a great volcanic eruption, Mount Toba out of the Pacific Islands. And that brought on a nuclear winter. And Homo sapiens might have gone through a bottleneck. But a few thousand years after that, humans started to escape the great drought which lay upon northern Africa. They crossed the Red Sea perhaps 65,000 years ago. That meant they had to have boats to do that. Instead of going into Europe, which was occupied by Neanderthals at that time, they went east. They got to Australia by 60,000 years ago. Now, that not just means boats. It means rather sophisticated navigational techniques because you're out of sight of land. You're over, you know, you're the expanses between islands down there are 60 miles or so. And, you know, given the shallow seas and the use of nets, which they probably had, you know, it was a piece of cake to get to Australia. And then that also applies to, the great island chains off of Japan. People were there 35,000 years ago, and therefore, of course, they were up on the China Sea for 40,000 years ago before a sign shows up in North America. Now, would those people want to have sat sunning themselves on the South China Sea for 40,000 years ago, having the kind of maritime technology that they had? I don't think so. I'll bet you they tried to ride up the coastline. I'll bet you they tried to get across the Kamchatka Peninsula into the Aleutian Chain many times. But there's no evidence. We have no evidence. Once they got to North America, they could have come down the coast. And that's any time in the last 30,000 years ago. You know, they could have popped into California, you know, which is an incredibly rich area with, you know, salmon and maritime, you know, whales and marine resources and the great chaparral of California. But for some reason, they did not. They did not stop and make sedentary villages and pump out children. They didn't do that until at least 12,000 years ago.
Well, let's talk about why they, if in fact there were people going down the coast, why they may not have chosen to stop in California and move inland. There were some pretty big animals roaming around North America at that time. In fact, huge predators that dwarf today's predators. And I can imagine it would have been a pretty dangerous place.
And that's absolutely what I believe. And in particular, it was the uniquely American giant short-faced bear. This is an animal that averaged well over a ton. The bigger specimens measure 7 feet at the hip. Standing up would have been a 15-foot bear. And this bear is a pure carnivore.
You're talking about a bear that's twice as big as the grizzly of today.
Twice as big as grizzlies today. And this is the bear that we know it lived off animals, and it could have been a predator, but mostly paleontologists think it was a scavenger, and that basically precluded humans hunting big game. Now, anybody coming out of the Arctic, you know, 30 or 15,000 years ago would have been a big game hunter. It's the only way you can survive an Arctic winter. But as they went south and they ran into especially the short-faced bear, they couldn't secure a kill. And that one animal could have precluded human colonization until 30,000 years ago. But the short-faced bear had a lot of company. We had lions on this continent that were the same genus as the African lion, but twice as big. And they measured the biggest cat craniums in history. And the implication is they were probably a pride-hunting social group of animals, really skilled predators. And we had saber-tooths. And we had an American cheetah that's twice as big as the African one. We had dire wolves. We had a great menagerie of grazing animals.
And there was the woolly mammoth, the mastodon, too.
The woolly mammoth, and further south, the Columbian mammoth. And, you know, they probably hybridized. So, you know, we had some species of the elephant family all through the Americas. The reason we know that they came by probably California is because we've got a couple early sites that predate Clovis. Clovis people are the first really successful colonizers in North America, but they don't show up until almost 13,000 years ago. But, you know, the oldest widely accepted date in North America for humans is way down in southern Chile, and that's about 14 or 14,500 years ago. Those people probably didn't walk. They probably the survivors of some kind of boat trip. And once you get into South America, for one thing, the gigantic short-faced bear didn't get down to South America. And I think that was the real, you know, the real difference. There's some challenge, but older dates from South America that date back 16,000, 20,000, 23,000, they're contested, but some of them might hold up. And if people got down there, they probably got down there by boat.
You know, one thing that seems to have happened is once these ancient ancestors, these old humans, invented the Clovis spear point, everything changed. I mean, it was the revolutionary technology where suddenly they could bring down a mammoth, and they were dangerous at that point.
That's true. It's you know, the first of a long line of iconic American inventions. You know, it was the fluted, deadly 6-inch Clovis spear point. You know, as beautiful and sleek as a Patriot missile, and that they're. We know nothing of these people except their material culture, pretty much. There's one Clovis burial, which I've been involved with for 15 years myself, it's very close to from where I live in Montana. It's only about 20 miles away. But we know very little about their spiritual life, except my educated guess, and supported by some evidence, is they did pop out of the corridor. They came down the corridor. They buried this child in northern Montana that's not far from the mouth of the corridor, and they spread out. Now, as far as radiocarbon dates, we've got all the Clovis sites in the world, and that's what we've got. We got the points. We got the dates. There's no evidence of a gradient there, whether they came out from the East Coast or from Texas or the southeastern United States or, you know, Montana and Alberta. They seem to show up everywhere. Within 100 years, you find this iconic, deadly Clovis mammoth hunting projectile point from New York to Panama, from Washington State to Florida. It's like people move so fast that it defies any kind of logic. You know, like there was a psychic energy going on that just compelled people, you know, to run over the next hillside, you know, looking for another band of or another oasis full of mammoth to hunt. And they followed them to the edges of the continent. And within 300 years ago, excuse me, within a period of 300 years, the Clovis people and the animals they hunted, the great megafauna of the late Pleistocene, went extinct and were gone.
That's one of the greatest mysteries in human history. In this relatively short period, all of these huge beasts that you were describing, everything from the mastodons and mammoths to the short-faced bears, the giant cheetahs, they were all gone in a fairly short period of time, and that time seemed to correspond to when the Clovis people were around.
That's exactly true. The most carefully excavated sites are in southeastern Arizona, and there's a event in the history of climate in North America. It's just called a Younger Dryas after a very beautiful alpine flower, but it was a sudden cooling that happened about 800 years ago, and we have rather precise dates from ice cores in Greenland and stuff like that, so we know when that happened. And across stratified Clovis sites in North America, it left a black line in the southwest. They're called black mats, and this layer of black, it's only an inch or two thick. You find Clovis projectile points and other tools right up to that black line. You also find the bones of extinct, all the great megafauna of the Pleistocene, you know, giant sloth, saber-tooth, mastodons, mammoths, dire wolves, and they all, and again, you don't find those bones, you find them right up to that black mat line, but not within that layer and not above it. And it's like a curtain just closed. Now, Clovis people probably survived. At least some of them did, and maybe they kept a few Clovis points around for another 100 years or so here and there. But it is an uncanny event. It coincides with a cooling. It was a significant cooling, about 37 degrees Fahrenheit in according to Greenland ice cores. And at the same time, we had our global warming that started about 14.7 thousand years ago. And that, no doubt, started to fragment habitats.
You know? Well, I mean, you're raising two possibilities as to what may have caused all of these huge animals to go extinct. It was global warming at that point. You know, the earlier version of global warming, or maybe these ancient humans hunted them into extinction.
I don't think either one quite stands up by itself. Human beings certainly didn't kill off all of those animals when Clovis showed up, because those animals were beginning, according to some studies, they were on the decline and moving around a lot, 14,000 years ago. But so you've got the habitat is being fragmented. You're removing top predators from ecosystems, and you know that sometimes has incredible destabilizing effects, like it has today when you take a wolf or a grizzly out of a mountain range. And we don't begin to understand those things, but it really very much looks like the coup de grace was hunting by humans and probably the Clovis hunters. And yet it stops in an instant. So on top of all of that, you've got the decline of the great herds of horses and camels and mammoths and bison by global warming. And then all of a sudden you've got the incredible rapidity and madness apparent madness of Clovis hunters just spearing everything in sight. And then on top of that, we have a sudden cooling event when everything stops. We can't attribute the extinction of the Pleistocene megafauna to any one of those events. It's probably some kind of combination. And most people think, you know, it was the global warming event. The animals wouldn't have gone extinct without the addition of human hunting.
Doug, I know one of the reasons why you're so fascinated by this history is you have been for decades kind of entranced by what it's like to live alongside a top predator. I mean, for you, it's been the grizzly bear. You've lived among them for decades now. And you have said that the psychic landscape changes once you are in their presence. Once you're in the presence of an animal that could easily kill you if it so chose to. Can you talk about that?
It does transform the psychic landscape like nothing else can. You know, you take your Kelty pack and you hike in the High Sierras or anywhere in Colorado, and you're top dog. You walk down the trail and you can be thinking about your girlfriend or your portfolio or something else. But you know, you added a grizzly bear to that equation, and all of a sudden you're in grizzly country. You're not the top of the food chain, and you're not in charge. And you necessarily start looking around. Your perspective is externalized, and you smell better, you hear better. And, you know, I don't use trails. I've been chasing grizzlies now, well, you know, it's 45 years or a little more. And I also fight to protect them, too, because in a way they saved my life when I came back from Vietnam, because what I needed after two tours as a Green Beret medic in Vietnam was to get out of myself. You know, the last thing I needed was self-indulgence. And when you enter grizzly country, where you're living with an animal that if it chooses could kill and eat you anytime it wants to, self-indulgence is just utterly impossible.
Can you take me back to that, to your first encounter with a grizzly shortly after you came back from Vietnam?
Yeah. I came back from Vietnam, and like a lot of other vets, I was out of sorts. I couldn't be around people. The one place I've always been comfortable in my life is in wilderness. You know, I was raised that way. And so, you know, I found myself camping out in the Rocky Mountains. And as the snows melted, I went north and north. And I had a malaria attack in the Wind River Range of Wyoming. And I thought I'd go heal myself in Yellowstone after that. And Yellowstone is, relatively speaking, a flatter place. The weather's much better. And so I'm I go into a thermal area in Yellowstone, and this is the old days when you kind of camp any place you want any time. And I was going to, you know, soak in the hot springs, like the notion of a spa, you know, and regain my health. And so one day I'm in this little tiny hot creek, which isn't very big, but it starts out boiling hot and it ends up in a river tepid. So you go upstream or downstream, you got any temperature water you want. And I was in a pretty hot bathtub, just a little thing where, you know, there's a little waterfall pouring water over my neck. And I had seen a grizzly bear once in Alaska when I was a punk kid, when I was 21 years old. And I dragged out my .44 mag, and after a second, I knew I was never going to shoot that bear anyway. And the bear just kind of took a look at us and just whiffed and blew off. That didn't make an impression. But here I am soaking in this hot spring in Yellowstone after the war, and I look off to the side across the meadow, about 200 feet away, was a mother grizzly and two yearlings. And this is as close as any bear I've ever seen in my life. And I didn't know anything about grizzlies then, except you weren't supposed to be around mothers with cubs. So I decided I was going to climb a tree. And on the bank of this little tiny creek, which is no more than 4 feet across, there was a lodgepole tree. And so I decided when she wasn't looking, I was going to go up that tree. So she turned, and I stood up. And, you know, the whirlpool-like effect of on my brain, all the hot water caused me to black out. But I was terrified. And so I grabbed this tree head on, bashed it with my head, cut a huge gash in my forehead. Blood's pouring down my eyes. But I'm still so scared, I climb up to the top of this lodgepole pine tree. And it's cold. It's 40 degrees, and it's October, and the wind is blowing like hell. And I get to the top of this tree, and I find out that it's not much bigger than a Christmas tree. And this mother grizzly and her two yearling, they graze in the area for 40 minutes. They come within 20 feet of me. They never look up. They know I'm there. They just ignore me. And I'm sitting up there like some kind of silly bird, you know, blue from cold, bleeding. Those bears got my attention. They got my attention.
They said they did more than that. They changed your life, it sounds like.
Well, they did. They did because, you know, that I'm a critic of our society. And that's what I think a writer has to be. And I inherited that from my old friend and mentor, Edward Abbey. And, you know, the easiest exit from culture is wilderness. You go up in wilderness, and after 3 or 4 days, something happens, and you're free of culture. And you're able to look back upon your own kind and your own ways with an objective mind, you know, that's free of judgment. And, you know, you add a grizzly bear to that occasion, and that's what allowed me to, you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. You know, those grizzly bears, as I once wrote in my first book, saved my life. And those same grizzly bears were having trouble by the early 70s, and I started, you know, I've donated a great hunk of my life to fighting for wild grizzlies, and I'm still fighting like crazy. The federal government wants to remove all protections for Yellowstone's grizzlies, and I'm going to fight them like hell on that one.
Well, and to put this in context, I mean, where you were when you had that first encounter with a grizzly, you just come back from Vietnam, you were a Green Beret medic. You were pretty shattered, weren't you, by what you saw over in Vietnam?
I was a medic, and I was there through the Tet Offensive, and the short story is I was responsible for, handled, and saw too many dead children. It was too much at the end. And, you know, I had gone sort of native by then in Vietnam, and the command knew it. They sent a they ordered me out of the field, sent a helicopter to pick me up, choppered me out. I was way up in the Central Highlands in Quang Nai Province. We flew out to the coast. They flew me up the coast on my last day in the field in Vietnam. We got shot at, which is no big deal. You get shot at in a helicopter all the time. But I looked at the map, and I said, oh, yeah, I know this place. I've been on the ground there. It was My Lai.
But you flew over during the My Lai Massacre?
Well, it was happening. March 16th, the morning of March 16th, 1968. A year later, I saw those pictures in Life magazine. Those pictures changed my life forever. You know, I was never going to be a candidate for reentering society, and I haven't yet.
So you landed back in America. You landed out in the woods, in the wilderness.
I camped out for several years, literally, truly.
Why was that so healing for you, that experience?
Basically, it was because of the grizzlies. You know, the grizzlies transformed that landscape. I mean, I love all wild country, any place, but living among grizzlies, I started to film them in the 70s, and, you know, that kind of gave a direction to my indulgence, which was merely the privilege of living out there alone in the wilderness with grizzly bears. But, you know, I wouldn't have had children if I hadn't been, you know, humanized in a bit by having to watch the great grizzly. And the great lessons of grizzly bears are actually lessons of tolerance, lessons of restraint, and above all, in its enforced humility, you know. And humility is really what I needed to open my own mind. It's the emotional posture behind reason.
Grizzlies are also pretty dangerous. I mean, did you have any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I've been charged over 30 times, almost always mothers with cubs. It was always my fault. But I stood my ground. A lot of those are false charges, but some of them were, you know. If I'm in a situation, 80% of all injuries to human beings are mother grizzlies protecting their young when they're surprised on day beds. And when during the day when it's hot, grizzlies sleep on day beds and they really sack out. So you can get closer than you want to be to a mother grizzly. And in the early days, I wasn't quite as astute at discerning where these day beds were going to be, and I got too close a number of times. And when a grizzly's charging me, I turned my head off to the side, because that's what bears do to one another when they're, you know, a frontal orientation to a bear is aggressive, and I didn't want to be aggressive. And I hold my arms out, and I'll talk gently. And I don't think it matters what you say so much as how you say it, and I don't move a muscle. And one of those mother grizzlies charged all the way, and about 6 feet away, skidded on her heels. She came so close to me, she leaned forward and sniffed my pant leg. And then after about 3 seconds, maybe four, it seemed like an eternity, but it wasn't very long, she just turned around, spun, and ran off, you know. So that's happened. It's happened a lot of times to me. And
were you terrified
no bear
when that
has
happened?
Touched, pardon?
Were you terrified?
Not during those moments. You know, a fear of bears is healthy, but I have bear dreams all the time. And my guess is that I work out my fear of grizzlies in my dreams. And when I'm out in the ground, fear doesn't happen to me. You know, I understand bears. I have relationships with a few individual grizzlies. There are dangerous bears, and I'm very careful around them. You really got to pay attention. You know, you have to remain alert. And again, all that adds up to having a very healthy external point of view, you know, like the Clovis people had. You know, when you're living as a hunter in a land full of saber-toothed tigers and giant short-faced bears, you know, you are going to externalize your senses and use them to every extent. You're going to have a sense of alertness that we modern humans could learn a lot from those kind of relationship with animals that are now so rare. It's just it's a privilege to even have one in your backyard.
You mentioned that you often have bear dreams. Do you ever feel like you're communicating with bears in your dreams?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, one of my types of dreams is there's a mother grizzly out there, and she's got a bear cub, but the other cub is my daughter, and walking, you know, crawling along on all fours, and but I'm worried about my daughter. Sometimes my grizzlies are not quite natural. They're just distorted just a bit. And they can take on the specter of legend and of fear, a really terrible animal, like an animal of your dreams almost. I have relationship with the grizzlies in my dreams. I'm sometimes really close to them. I mean, like 4 or 5 feet away. That has happened to me in wild nature a couple times, but I mean, it happens all the time in my dreams. And, you know, the bear and I we have a relationship. We're not talking, but, you know, I know when it's dangerous and when it's not dangerous. And those dream relationship have spilled over into my real life, and I've experienced that out there on the ground with wild grizzlies.
Well, as you were describing your dreams, I was wondering if these were just your projections. I mean, given how much time you spend around grizzlies, or do you think that maybe there really is some kind of communication? You're tapping into some kind of bear consciousness there.
Well, I would quietly answer yes to that. Those bears in my dreams and on the ground have taught me so much, and they've challenged me to look within myself and come up with new combinations that I never would have put together on my own. I really owe them for that.
Can you give me an example of that?
There's occasionally a rare animal that dominates a landscape, an entire mountain range, a single animal. And in my experience, those have been one or two huge male grizzlies. And I've had a personal relationship with those bears. And I tend to see them once a year because they're like whales, you know, coming around to the equator to feed, like Moby Dick. You know, my Moby Dick grizzly shows up in Glacier Park in a particular huckleberry patch, you know, every late September, and I'm there to greet him. And I don't stick around long generally because he lets me know he's cranky and he's dangerous to other grizzlies. I mean, I've seen him chase and fight and try to kill a sow grizzly and her yearling, and it was in a situation where I was on a narrow ridge. He didn't know I was there, and a storm was coming on, a serious storm, and I had to get to my camp. And 5 minutes after this inconclusive fight with a female grizzly where he tried to kill her, he's on this ridge, and I've got to go past him, and I have to talk with this bear. And the minute he hears my voice, his fur goes up, all the signs, his ears go back. That's all this, you know, you look at the eyes. Once you see the yellow, sclera, you're going to get charged. And all those things happen. And he made a huge kind of a hop charge because I was about 30, 40 feet away. He covered the first 15 to 20 feet in a single, like a leap, you know, like a hop charge. And then something happened, and I sat there, and I talked my silliness to him. I don't remember what I said. And something passed between us. I just felt something. And very slowly, you know, the ruff on his neck went down. His ears slowly went erect. This all happens in the course of 90 seconds or so. And he slowly turned his head to the side and just suddenly disappeared in the brush. I raced past him because he let me pass. He allowed me to pass, go up this ridge, set up a camp. That night I built a fire. I hardly ever build fires in bear country because I don't, you know, it's bears, and I don't like to drive them away with the smell of smoke unnecessarily. But that night I did, and, you know, an hour after dark, I could hear, and this is the pyramid-like mountaintop, very small but steep-sided. I could hear this animal coming up the side of the mountain, and I get some burning twigs, and they don't burn very well because there's nothing that burns, you know, up in the top of the mountain. I get a bunch of spruce twigs, lay them with toilet paper, go out to the side, and I see this great grizzly. He's 15 feet away. I can see the red of his eyes, and I talk to him a little bit, and he goes back down the mountain. An hour later, on a different side of the mountain, here he comes again. And I repeat this scene, you know, 4 or 5 times until about 2 in the morning, and he leaves me alone.
Those must have been some conversations you had with him.
He's my Moby Dick grizzly. The last time I saw him, You know, again, when he shows up, you got to get off the mountain. You know, he's the kind of bear. Most bears run away. You know, if you run into 20 grizzlies, 19 are going to turn and run away. It's only a very dominant bear that doesn't. And this is the bear that would look you right in the face. And that what that means is, peacock, get the hell off my mountain. And when he does that, I do it. But so this happened one day, and then the grizzly was looked at me, and he went and he ate some huckleberries, and he went to a bedding site. I didn't know exactly where. But I decided I was going to wait a little bit before I started down the mountain so I wouldn't disturb other grizzlies. And I took a little hike along the ridge of this, you know, it's subalpine, and little clumps of trees on the little bumps on the ridge. And, you know, I'm very careful because grizzlies can bed in that. And I'm making my way towards this clump of trees. And I know it could be a day bed. So I'm moving quietly, silently, as slow as possible. And all of a sudden, I feel something kind of vibrate on my skull. And it's the lowest, deepest growl I've ever heard in my life. And it's coming from this clump of trees. It's only about 50 feet away. And I know it's him. And then if I come one more step and disturb his nap, I'm going to pay the price. And so I backed off the slowest steps you ever saw, just backed off slowly, hit the ridge, grabbed my pack, and got down to the bottom of the mountain in record time.
Well, speaking of wild characters, I want to ask you about Ed Abbey, your old friend, great
yeah.
writer, environmentalist, and from all that I've heard, a rather cantankerous fellow. Why did the two of you hit it off so well?
You know, we shared a great love of wilderness and the need to defend wilderness. And we were one with that from the beginning. And, you know, you're right about it. You know, he was a cantankerous son of a bitch, and I was worse. I was a complete, you know, wacko, non-vet, long before we had names like post-traumatic stress and stuff like that. And when Ed Abbey wrote The Monkey Wrench Gang and he based a character crudely on Peacock, man, he nailed that. And that was, you know, that was 5 years or 10 years before they came up with official category and diagnosis of post-traumatic stress. So he has this crazy character, Hayduke, you know.
Who's based on you. I mean,
yeah.
This Green Beret medic, right?
Yeah, right on. Yeah.
But I've heard that you were not exactly crazy about that fictional portrait of you.
Well, yes. You know, it's okay because Ed and I made our peace with that. But, you know, when you just pluck the external characteristics of a person you know and put them in a book without kind of asking about it, you run the risk of, you know, a mutual friend once said to me, you know, Doug, friends don't do that to one another. But Ed Abbey was a writer above all, and he's going to steal anything he wanted. Hayduke was kind of adult, and I don't feel that I'm quite adult. And but it's all right. There was, you know, the phrase Hayduke lived was scratched on barroom, bathroom walls throughout the West, you know, and so I got a little bit of glitz while, you know, while I suffered a little dolt-like humiliation. Ed and I, you know, it strained our friendship, but we got rid of it right away. The publishers of The Monkey Wrench Gang, Lippincott, had Ed write, the lawyers had Ed write me this really embarrassing letter about I should only take the good parts of Hayduke and forget the other stuff like that. It was awful. It was horrible. So, you know, let's see, when was that? I think it was late winter of 1975, 1976. We were both living in Moab, Utah, and we took a hike up Mill Creek Canyon. And when you get up there a few miles, there's a split in the canyon. There's a great rock in the middle. And on the rock are petroglyphs, which accurately are a map of the area. It's a really sacred place. And so Ed and I went up there, and I took out this letter, and we ceremonially burned the son of a bitch. And neither one of us ever spoke about the origins of George W. Hayduke to the other again.
Now, I know you were with Ed Abbey in the final days before he died. How did he approach his own death?
Oh, man. He died a great death. Just as brave and clear-eyed as any I've seen. And I've seen a lot of death. And that's the legacy of the kind of life I've chosen to live and the fact that I came out of war. But, I was with Ed it took him about a week or so to die, and I was with him every day, and I was with him all the last night of his life, alone with Ed. Last time he smiled was when I told him where he was going to be buried. But I remember going in to see Ed in the hospital bed, and he died of esophageal varices, which, you bleed from your throat. It's a condition most commonly associated with cirrhosis of the liver, which Ed did not have, but he had another complication that caused his portal hypertension. And I went in to see him because I talked him into an operation that might have saved his life had he done it 6 months ago. And I said, do it for the kids. What do you got to lose? Anyway, I went back in to the room after the operation and Ed had, it was probably 12 hours. Ed had pulled out all the tubes, and he looked at me with the clearest eyes I've ever seen. He said, Douglas, it's time to go. And so we loaded him, Ed up in the back of Jack Leffler's pickup, and I started driving him out to a good place to be buried. And at the railroad tracks, Clark and pulled over. I was following behind. She said, Doug, he's going fast. Go to, So I took him to a place that I used to camp out. It's not far from Tucson. Not a bad place. And I could get there in 20 minutes. And so I built a little campfire and a little mesquite wash, and he sat in a chair for a bit, and then he decided it was time to die. So he got in a sleeping bag with Clark, and there were three of us then. We went over, and we all shook hands and said, goodbye, Ed. And we went back and waited, and along about daylight, 3 hours later, I heard Ed cough, and I kind of went over to see what was going on, and he looked up at me, and he said, Douglas, sometimes the magic doesn't work. But he did die a couple of days later,
and he wasn't ready to die in a beautiful
a beautiful illegal wilderness grave.
Wait, I'm sorry, say that again? Wait.
I said Ed finally did die, a couple of days later, and we took him out and buried him in a beautiful, illegal wilderness grave according to his last wishes.
Somewhere out in the desert, and no one else knows where that is, right?
Almost nobody. There's some guys writing a book who actually found it, but they're pretty cool about it. I told the guy who's the author of the book, I said, oh, well, I thought you were going to write a guidebook, have signposts out there or something like that. Well, no, the guy was doing his own odyssey, and he loves Ed Abbey, and he's not going to tell anybody where it is. I mean, it's all right. People happen to find the grave, though it's not easy to find. And, it's a reverent place. It's a spiritual place.
Do you go back and visit that grave site?
I do almost every year, virtually every year. It's been a long time now, 25 years, and I, I was there just, 20 yards away last year, kind of just sitting down and just watching the great desert valleys and ranges, looking at the ocotillo blossoms. Yeah, it's a beautiful place. We should be so lucky.
As you look back at your life, I mean, the trauma that you've described, going back to Vietnam and then these remarkable wilderness encounters you've had, your friendships with people like Ed Abbey, has this been a good life?
It's been an unbelievably lucky, great life.
And may it continue for quite some time.
Well, I'm glad you got me when you did, but me too.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Oh, Steve, mine too.
That was fabulous. Thank you.